I'm Marco Werman. We've reached our goal for the spring fundraiser. The world raised $134,000. That's $134,000 to help pay for the reporting that you depend on each day. It helps us meet the cost of bringing you the news, and it's proof that you value the world's journalism. Thank you for helping us make the world available for free to everyone. If you meant to contribute, there's still time. Go to theworld.org/give. And thank you for supporting the world. Feminine mystique and fighting disease, several nations have done extremely well battling the coronavirus, places where women are in charge.
Women tend to be somewhat more participative, so more willing to listen to advice and include different perspectives and try to weigh them up in their decisions.
One decision governments worry about, how to grow economies again. Amsterdam is looking to a future that meets both the needs of people and the planet.
That's like a moonshot of John F. Kennedy saying we're going to put a man on the moon and we don't know what materials and we don't know how to get there. It's that scale of ambition.
Most politicians, though, they don't want the moon. They want factories up and running as soon as possible.
But without putting your citizens' health at risk, it's a difficult equation.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Nobody is surprised by the economic news we're hearing, but still, it is unnerving to see the new numbers and forecasts. Europe is now facing its worst recession in its history. Here in the U.S., jobless claims are off the charts. People want to get back to work. One reliable path to recovery is getting a vaccine. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for our program. Remind us, first of all, why a vaccine is so critical, Ilana.
So, Marco, one researcher described it to me like this. A vaccine is the most, quote, magical of game changers. So you can have a lot of powerful treatments, even and drugs that are developed for someone who's been infected, who's sick. But with a vaccine, if it works, it means people don't get infected at all. And if you don't get infected, you're not spreading the disease.
So the competition we know is pretty fierce to get to a vaccine. I've heard some efforts being described as a kind of Manhattan Project at that level. What kind of progress is being made?
There are so many vaccine trials happening right now, like dozens of them around the globe. Companies have just dropped everything to focus on this. And Gary Kobinger tells me that this is just truly amazing. He is the director of an infectious disease research center at the University of Laval in Quebec City, and he's actually working on developing one of those vaccines.
It took us exactly 7 days, but we put another 7 days to produce enough to start studying and testing.
So what are the risks of this very energetic race to get to a vaccine?
Vaccine trials are designed and built in about studying risk. A big part of it is testing for side effects and how safe they are. Finally, Marco, there's this other thing that I think is really important to understand, and that is that it's actually a sign of success if many of these vaccines fail and fail fast. So here's Gary Kobinger again.
You start at 80, but it's important that people drop out as soon as there is something better that can continue so that we can focus efforts on that.
So you want to see the harms that might happen or poor side effects. You want to see that come out early and drop those vaccines. And the other thing is it's not just about having one vaccine that comes out, but hopefully or likely several vaccines.
It sounds like a really high stakes process of elimination. So, Ilana, the question everybody wants answered is when? When will there be an actual vaccine? What is the timeline?
The timeline is getting very crunched. Some scientists and leaders we've heard say maybe as early as this fall. Again, Ebola took about a year and a half to develop. And so there are reasons for that, but many are saying, hey, we've learned that from that and we can do better.
How have researchers and scientists been able to speed this process up so quickly?
Part of it is that there are a lot of resources that are involved in setting up and executing a vaccine trial. And that's why we've seen so much massive investment right now from countries, from Europe, from the U.S., and all these sorts of things to put in hundreds of millions of dollars to do that right now.
When we think about reopening the economies of the world, the final step in developing that vaccine, is there enough manufacturing capacity to make enough of it?
That is so important because you can have a vaccine, but you need to be able to have the capacity to get that vaccine to people. There may be a level or tiering out of who gets it, like frontline health workers first. But I mean, there's, what, 8 billion people around the globe? So that's why there's conversations now around manufacturing capacity and how to do this. There's also the concerns that countries could try to control the manufacturing and distribution of a vaccine. That happened with the last flu pandemic, H1N1.
The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. Thanks very much, Alana.
Thanks, Marco.
If we wait too long for a vaccine, we'll do severe damage to our economies. It's a terrible calculation that politicians, business leaders, and scientists are weighing. Open things up, but at what cost to human life? It's an even trickier equation in a globalized world. The Trump administration and some major American manufacturers are antsy and pressuring Mexico to reopen factories. They want North American supply chains rolling again. Jorge Guajardo is a former Mexican ambassador and now works for McClarty Associates in Washington. Ambassador, Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador is under enormous pressure to open up or reopen up U.S. factories in Mexico, but it appears the spread of the coronavirus has not even reached its peak yet in Mexico. How important is it to get these factories up and running?
There are several angles to that question. And yes, you're right. The peak is supposed to hit Mexico on May 8th. Clearly, this is a time in which Mexico has got to be very careful in how it goes about opening up its economy. At the same time, Mexico took measures at shutting down many industries that were allowed to operate in other countries as the pandemic progressed from geographies. So there's been also some confusion by manufacturers in why Mexico is closing certain industries that were either deemed essential in other countries or allowed to operate even if not deemed essential. So there's been some confusion on what industries can and should operate while at the same time making sure that the government looks after the health of its citizens. And we have to be very careful in how we go about reopening the economy.
Right. And it's not just May 8th, you hit the peak and everything is fine again. You still have to flatten the curve and keep on flattening it. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Christopher Landau, warned that if Mexico does not open its factories, it will cost Mexico jobs. Are you worried that if Mexico doesn't open up factories, American companies will take their work elsewhere?
Yes and no. No, because companies that started production in Mexico did not so to create Mexican jobs. They did so because it benefited their bottom line, and that will be the case in a post-COVID world. They've done well. They have a free trade agreement, so they have everything going for them. On the other hand, these are great opportunities for Mexico to capitalize the reshaping of the supply chain. Probably as companies move out of China, they may consider setting up shop in Mexico. However, after all this confusion and lack of clarity from the Mexican government, it will certainly raise questions on U.S. company boards when they say, you know, what's happening in Mexico? Why is our supply chain all of a sudden interrupted? And what are we doing to address this?
Do you have enough sense of how willing President López Obrador is to put people's health and livelihoods at risk to satisfy the U.S. pressure to open those factories?
That's a good question. I hope that won't be the criteria. Like every president around the world, he's weighing the pros and cons, the challenges it represents for the economy, the longer you stay closed, and the lost opportunities for the supply chains, while at the same time trying to capitalize on a regional trading bloc that we've established, but without putting your citizens' health at risk. It's a difficult equation.
Many of the factories in Mexico that are slated to reopen are in COVID-19 hotspots like Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez. There are people in Mexico who worry that Mexico will repeat Italy's mistake, keeping factories open until it was too late to control the spread. So what leverage do health officials in Mexico actually have? Like, who is the Anthony Fauci of Mexico? What do they say?
So Mexico has sort of put all the COVID strategy in the hands of one undersecretary of health, who's been somewhat controversial. So we're all in the hands of somebody who's determining the policies of the entire country, but is not in contact with the rest of the actors or sectors. So that makes it complicated.
Former Mexican Ambassador Jorge Guajardo, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
New Zealand's coronavirus death toll is 21 people. In Taiwan, it's 6. Germany is faring much better than most of its neighbors. Denmark, Finland, Iceland, and Norway also turning in stellar report cards. The common theme here, all places led by women. Coincidence? Here's the world's Orla Barry.
When Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern imposed a lockdown in March, no one in New Zealand had died from the coronavirus. Compare that to Britain. On the day the UK went into lockdown, 335 people had already died from COVID-19. Ardern was holding daily press conferences to call for unity. She also shared her thoughts in a series of Facebook Live videos from her sofa.
Excuse the casual attire. Can be a messy business putting toddlers to bed, so I'm not...
Ardern's videos were personal and empathetic.
We won't see the positive benefits of all of the effort you were about to put in for self-isolation for a few days yet, so don't be disheartened.
And her strategy is paying off. While New Zealand's death rate has stayed low, Ardern's popularity ratings have soared. So does her leadership style have anything to do with being a woman? Zoe Marks at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government says not at all.
That is not an inherently feminine mode of communication to bring your followers and citizens into an intimate conversation about the collective welfare of the country. And, you know, the fireside chat originated with Franklin Roosevelt in the U.S. The problem is not that only women can pull it off. It's that men are afraid to really let their guard down and be relatable.
Denmark's Prime Minister has also been unafraid to let her guard down. Mette Frederiksen posted a video of herself and her partner doing the dishes and singing along to the weekly TV lockdown sing-along show. Frederiksen, who's earned a reputation for being a straight talker, was also quick to put a lockdown in place. As for Germany's Angela Merkel, Facebook videos are not her style. Merkel has a background as a scientist, and that's been coming through in the way she's dealing with the pandemic.
Die Kurve ist flacher geworden. Es bleibt nach wie vor so, sie muss so sein, dass sie...
Germany is now coming out of its lockdown. But what's this all got to do with these leaders being women? Suze Wilson teaches leadership at Massey University in New Zealand, and she says there isn't a simple answer.
There are some differences. So women tend to be somewhat more participative in their approach, so more willing to listen to advice and include different perspectives and try to weigh them up in their decisions.
But Wilson says it's unhelpful to place too much emphasis on gender differences. Jennifer Tomlinson, Professor of Gender and Employment Relations at the University of Leeds, agrees.
This idea of women having particular attributes or a particular leadership style, I think that is fairly out of date now. I mean, there is some evidence, slightly mixed, that maybe women are more collaborative in their style. It's not to say that men can't do collaborative leadership.
All the Nordic countries, with the exception of Sweden, are led by women right now. And all the Nordic countries, with the exception of Sweden, also have low rates of infection for COVID-19, which does seem striking. The pandemic is highlighting the successes of female leaders, says Rosie Campbell. She's a professor of politics at King's College London. But it's also showing how a certain very male type of leadership is proving to be ineffective, she says.
We've had this tide of populist, macho, strongmen leaders who have deliberately chosen to portray themselves that way, to be invulnerable. And actually, I think there's a lot of bluff and a lot of bluster involved in that. And I'm afraid COVID does not respond very well to bluff and bluster. It has to be treated scientifically.
Here in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's initial approach to the pandemic was seen as pretty cavalier.
I was at a hospital the other night where I think there were actually a few coronavirus patients, and I shook hands with everybody, you'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands. And
Johnson has since changed his approach after ending up in intensive care with COVID-19. Several world leaders who've been praised for their handling of the crisis also happen to be men. After all, women still represent only 7% of all heads of state globally. And Suze Wilson says just getting elected remains a huge challenge for them.
It's a little bit easier for a relatively average man to slip through, but it's very, very difficult for a relatively average woman to slip through.
Wilson says maybe the success that female leaders are having with the coronavirus pandemic will get people's attention by showing that women are actually quite good at dealing with the crisis. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The economic fallout of the pandemic is hitting all of us, but there's big new thinking on how to rebuild the global economy. That's just ahead. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Another 3 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits. That makes 33 million out of a job since the pandemic hit. The unemployment rate could soon hit a staggering 20%, a rate not seen since the Great Depression. We're not alone. The economic pain is everywhere. The World's Chris Wolf has more.
The governing body of the European Union, the European Commission, said this week it is projecting a 7% downturn in the EU economy for 2020. Paolo Gentiloni is the Commission's economic chief.
COVID-19 abruptly changed our previous outlook. Economic activity in the EU dropped by around one-third, practically overnight.
The Bank of England today released an even more pessimistic assessment. It expects the UK economy to shrink 14% for the whole year. But both the EU and the Bank of England hope there will be a full recovery. That would be what economists call a V-shaped recession. Quick down, quick up. Paolo Gentiloni again.
Once the pandemic is under control and containment measures can be progressively eased, the European economy should start to recover in the second half of this year.
President Trump is also hoping for a quick rebound.
Our country has to go back to being our country again. You have people that are not going to stand for this.
The administration is calculating that things will simply return to normal once the virus passes. A quick bounce back is possible. Economists disagree on the probability of that, however. The EU's Gentiloni warned of more economic damage if the virus continues to spread.
Containment measures would have to be maintained or reinstated, further damaging the economy and the rebound that we are forecasting for 2021.
Elsewhere, China's exports jumped unexpectedly in April. They're actually higher than they were in April last year. But economists say that could be largely just filling up the slack created by the economic freeze across much of China in the first quarter. China, too, could face a rough year if the markets that normally buy Chinese goods remain depressed. Overall, many of the world's economic leaders are expressing some confidence. But Austria's finance minister, Gernot Blümel, says he thinks it could be a bluff.
I think that are too optimistic because we just are not able to say clearly how long this crisis will last.
For the world, I'm Chris Wolf.
Many governments are infusing their economies with cash in an attempt to get back on the path of economic growth. But one city is taking a different approach toward the post-pandemic recovery. That's today on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The city of Amsterdam has released a recovery plan that does not prioritize future economic growth. Instead, it's trying out an untested economic model that aims to meet the needs of both people and the planet. The world's Anna Kusmer has a story.
In pre-corona times, Amsterdam was one of the most visited places in Europe. At this time last year, the city and surrounding towns were swarmed with more than a million tourists, there to see the legendary Dutch tulips in bloom. Now the gardens are empty. Amsterdam officials say the pandemic could shrink the economy as much as 8% and push unemployment as high as 9%. So the city has come up with a recovery plan.
What we are looking at is how we can become a healthy and a resilient city again.
Marika van Doorning is deputy mayor of Amsterdam.
We're going to look at how we're going to make sure that people actually do have a job again.
Van Doorning's office released its plan on how to do that in early April. But it looks a little different than you might expect from a post-pandemic recovery plan. It doesn't have goals for economic growth or GDP. Instead, it has goals for making life in Amsterdam better for people and the planet. Van Doorning says the pandemic has encouraged a change in priorities.
It gives us the opportunity to put those other values like social interaction, health, solidarity much more in forefront of how we're going to recover.
The city's recovery plan focuses on ensuring affordable housing and jobs, revamping recycling programs, and cutting food waste. With this plan, Amsterdam is the first city to embrace an economic framework called Donut Economics, created by British economist Kate Raworth in 2012.
The donut is a compass for human prosperity in the 21st century.
The donut is a visual aid for Raworth's economic theory. The hole in the middle of the donut represents the social stuff we don't have enough of, like safe housing, adequate food, and fresh water. Outside the donut is the environmental stuff we have too much of, like pollution and carbon in the atmosphere. The doughy ring is where we want to be, says Raworth. Enough of the good stuff, not too much of the bad.
So the aim of the donut is to meet the needs of all people within the means of the living planet. And the donut is the starting point. Then donut economics ask, what kind of economic thinking gives us even half a chance of getting there?
A key part of that economic thinking, Raworth says, is no longer using GDP as a proxy for a society's success.
And it's very, very different from the economic thinking of the 20th century, which predominantly pursued endless GDP growth. We need to move from endless growth to thriving imbalance.
Raworth's donut framework has never been put to the test before. Free market economists say the ambitious programs needed to meet social needs and protect the environment are impossible without massive economic growth. But Raworth says we should be agnostic about growth and focus instead on developing programs that meet social needs with the lightest possible environmental footprint. Like affordable housing. In Amsterdam, about a fifth of tenants can't afford rent, says Van Doorning.
Many people are extremely worried about whether they have a possibility to actually rent or buy a house in the city because the prices are so extremely high.
The city has to figure out a way to build more housing stock without overshooting its pollution targets. That means using recyclable materials as much as possible and accounting for carbon emitted in the production of those materials, even when they're made far away from the city. Amsterdam is the first government to embrace donut economics, but Edward Mueller at the University for International Cooperation in Costa Rica has been working with Raworth's ideas for years.
I have it a lot easier than Amsterdam because I have a whole country to work with.
In this economy, more reliant on agriculture, Mueller's focus isn't on housing, but on helping herders and farmers move toward more environmentally friendly practices.
I have to reduce the amount of fertilizers in the case of Costa Rica. We have to cut down CO2 emissions. We have to reverse degradation of ecosystems.
Amsterdam's programs aiming at transforming the city by 2050 will roll out in the next 5 years. It won't be easy, says Raworth. But the disruption of the pandemic is providing a window of opportunity for big new ideas like hers.
That's like a moonshot of John F. Kennedy saying we're going to put a man on the moon and we don't know what materials and we don't know how to get there. It's that scale of ambition.
Raworth says finding solutions starts with thinking differently about old problems. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
News headlines are next. You're with The World. We've all heard the message, stay home, but what if you're not welcome at home? Calls to helplines from LGBTQ people are spiking.
Someone called me to tell me that she's at home with her family and they are quite homophobic and they're making it difficult for her, not even giving her food.
Isolated during social isolation, that's still coming up on The World. Voting when there's a pandemic is tricky, tough to social distance at the ballot box. In Poland, the ruling conservative government was pushing for presidential elections this Sunday, a vote by mail. But some lawmakers rebelled, and the ruling Law and Justice Party, or PiS, agreed to postpone things. When and how exactly Poles will vote, still unclear. The mayor of Warsaw, Rafał Trzaskowski, is a member of the opposition party, Civic Platform. He's been against a quick vote.
I mean, the problem was that they wanted to do it, you know, like a month ago. They wanted to rush the election through. And they wanted to do it in 3 weeks. And there was not enough time to actually prepare the postal ballot according to the rules of democracy. Now it seems that there is more time. And in 2 months, postal elections could be prepared in a way which is democratic. I mean, first of all, agreed by the parliament with a new bill. And secondly, giving ample time to actually prepare it well and do it with the electoral committee, which is in Poland independent. And in this sense, this is a win for the opposition and a win for the local government because we are the ones who have the voter registers and we didn't want to give them to Law and Justice because we were absolutely certain that there were no grounds in law for us to do it. Now, if a new bill passes through the parliament, there will be grounds in law and it will be constitutional, and then the whole election could go through. But we are not sure whether it's not another trick by Learn Justice.
In other words, they were pushing for this at a time when they stood a better chance of getting reelected.
Exactly. Regardless of safety, regardless of democratic procedure, they were just pushing it because they knew that for time being, they're still in an advantageous position. Because, you know, there is this thing everywhere in the world, you know, rally around the flag. And it's true about Poland as well, that now in the middle of the epidemic, regardless of how the government is seen, people tend to support it. And in 3-4 months, it might be completely different because of economic downturn, difficult decisions to be made. And also, I mean, this government is not dealing with the epidemic as professionally as they should. And in 2-3 months, it might become clearly visible.
The European Union has long accused the Law and Justice Party of undermining Polish democracy. You're in the opposition party. What do you think is at stake for Poland in this election?
Listen, I mean, you know, we are still a democratic country, but unfortunately, you know, our constitutional court has been politicized. Unfortunately, the constitution is being trampled upon by this government. Unfortunately, this government is not treating the rule of law as they should. I mean, they're politicizing all the institutions. The public broadcaster has been turned into a tube of propaganda of incredible character. I mean, I remember the communist times. It was more subtle in the communist times. So they are trampling upon the most important principles of democracy. But now the really free character of the elections was at stake. Because, I mean, we are still a democratic country with quite a lot of problems. And as I've said, with the constitution being broken. But if they were to actually prepare elections which would not be democratic and which would not be a secret, that would go one bridge too far.
So what is it like being a mayor of a major world city in a pandemic, making sure that people are taken care of, hospitals and healthcare workers are taken care of, and juggling these mixed messages that Poles are getting from their local council in Warsaw and from the national conservative government?
It's not easy. I mean, it's, you know, I've been in contact with the mayors of Budapest and Istanbul. They have exactly the same problems. But sometimes these problems, you know, you see them elsewhere in the U.S. as well. I'm in contact with my friends, mayors of the biggest cities in the U.S., and they also have problems with the federal government because, you know, in Poland, the responsibility for dealing with pandemic is that of the government. And they're the ones with all the instruments to assess the situation. They're the ones who have the money to deal with it and so on and so forth. We are the ones, on the other hand, who are battling on the first front. So it is sometimes difficult to reconcile that. For the first 6-7 weeks of the pandemic, we were cooperating, and I had a feeling that we can do it above the political fray. But unfortunately now, I mean, you know, more and more, well, we have those suspicions that some of those decisions are motivated politically, so it gets more difficult. But of course, you know, my main concern now is to make sure that people in Warsaw are safe, that all the functions of the city are provided, that city functions well when it comes to water, sanitation, public transportation, and so on and so forth. This is my utmost priority, to protect people in hospitals, because 10 of Warsaw's hospitals are under my authority, to protect people in preschools and kindergartens, because, you know, I will open them when I'm sure that it's relatively safe and that the personnel and the kids are protected. So there is a great responsibility on us. And unfortunately, sometimes the government is trying to push that responsibility our way without providing us with sufficient means. And we have to do it on our own.
And now with the cherished Chopin piano competition delayed until 2021, you don't even have your national treasure to ease the tension.
Well, yes, this is really sad that cultural events had to be postponed. I think that this is not only the case of Poland, but everywhere in Europe and in the United States. If we stop investing, if we stop supporting the creative industry, if we stop supporting the hospitals and so on and so forth, and the educational system, then the downturn will be even more serious. So here, I think that's the same interest of the government and the local government, is to continue with investment and to continue with supporting these industries. And that's what we are trying to tell the government. And hopefully they will listen, because that's really important for us all.
Rafał Trzaskowski is the mayor of Warsaw. He's with the Liberal Opposition Party Civic Platform. Mayor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, and take care.
Lebanon has done remarkably well with the pandemic so far. The country has recorded fewer than 1,000 cases of COVID-19 and about 24 deaths. Lebanon locked down early and locked down hard and averted a medical crisis. But as Rebecca Collard reports from Beirut, that has only made the country's economic crisis worse.
Protesters are back in the streets here and they have a message for the government.
Some people are dying because they don't have a shelter to live in. They don't have food to eat.
Mohamed Kadan is with a crowd of protesters blocking a main road in Beirut. It's a bit of a bizarre scene. Some of the protesters are wearing masks and trying to keep a safe social distance between them. Others are clearly not. They're shouting in the faces of a row of police in riot gear. Smoke is rising from a nearby pile of garbage set on fire by the demonstrators. Another group of police officers is handing out medical masks to protesters, some of whom are carrying gas masks, just in case the police decide to fire tear gas to disperse the crowd. Protesting in the pandemic is different and possibly dangerous. But Kadan says he's at a breaking point. His salary as a medical technician has been slashed by more than two-thirds because of out-of-control inflation.
So that's it. I've got nothing to lose, actually.
In the narrow streets of Beirut's Burj Al Hamoud neighborhood, Bahir Solakian sits outside a small shop. On a portable radio, he listens to the national news, and it's not good.
Everyone is not working, and there is no much money, no food. Many families sleep without eating. It's all the people is very poor. Very, very, very poor.
Solakian works as a security guard. He never thought things would be this bad. Now he's relying on handouts from a local church.
A box of food, rice, milk, oil.
Solakian says he's never been wealthy, but with his salary, he was able to pay rent and feed his family of five. As the financial crisis hit in the fall, sparking the first wave of protests, things got harder for Solakian, but he managed. And then?
When corona comes, for example, Canada, United States, or Europe, all, government helps for the people. They say stay at home, but they pay them. But here, no money. No one helps us.
Lebanon's currency is in free fall. Inflation is so bad, prices of some goods shoot up overnight. The Lebanese pound was pegged to the U.S. dollar, and it stayed at 1,500 for decades. But earlier this year, it doubled to 3,000 on the black market. Solakian tells me emergency lockdown measures have made everything worse.
If they don't shut down, that will be much more illness. But the people is poor. That is the problem.
The lockdown in Lebanon worked. The infection rate flattened quickly, but inflation did not. In late April, the Lebanese pound jumped to more than 4,000 to the dollar. Prices went up as well, and those that were scraping by no longer could. And that sparked a new round of protests. In this video shot outside Beirut, protesters and security forces are seen clashing. The protesters are shouting, "I am hungry." One of the officers shouts back, "I am hungrier than you." On a quiet day in the city center, Ghazi El Amaldin sits chatting with a friend on the sidewalk. A year ago, he tells me he was making $35 or $40 a day working in construction. It wasn't great, but it was enough to get by and feed his family. When the pandemic started, the work he did have dried up. He pulls out his pockets to show that he's broke.
No, I'm not receiving any money from anywhere, and my family is staying with my wife's parents. My children and my wife are staying with her parents. And it's been 15 days that I haven't seen my kids.
There was no way to feed them at home, he says. Thankfully, there's a local mosque giving out free meals in the evening for Ramadan. At this point, Alam El-Din's face tightens up as he tries to fight back tears. The situation is tough for everyone now, he says. He says Lebanon is a beautiful country, and his hope is that it will stand on its two feet again. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
We've all had that moment when we open up Facebook, you see something and wonder, huh, is it really okay to post that? Facebook is taking a big step in tightening the rules. It's announced the first members of a new global oversight board. Together, they'll make the final call on what content gets to stay and what has to go. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou has been following this effort. So remind us, first of all, Lydia, what this board is and why Facebook wanted to set it up in the first place.
Sure. So as you know, Marco, every single day, Facebook has to make decisions about the things that users post on its site. And those decisions have huge consequences. The best example of this is what we saw in Myanmar a few years ago, where you had extremists using Facebook to spread rumors and to incite violence against the Rohingya. That's the, you know, the mostly Muslim minority group there. And Facebook wasn't quick enough to take those posts down. And they've been accused of playing a role in what eventually became a brutal crackdown against the Rohingya.
Right. And the Rohingya example is not the only one where Facebook was criticized for taking something down or leaving something up.
Exactly. So for more than a year now, they've been working on putting together this independent board that's going to have the final say on these decisions. They're not going to be the first line of defense. Facebook is still going to have this army of content moderators to make initial decisions about what has to be taken down and what can stay up. But the most controversial and high stakes decisions will be elevated to this board. And this is why Facebook's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, has compared it to a Supreme Court-like panel in the past.
A Supreme Court-like panel, fairly powerful. So yesterday, Facebook announced the first few members. Who are they and how were they selected?
So in terms of the selection process, Facebook initially handpicked four people who are going to be co-chairs of the board. And ultimately, it's going to be 40 people. Yesterday, we found out who the first 20 are going to be.
This board is made up of people from all over the world and with different backgrounds and perspectives.
That's Catalina Botero Marino. She's one of the board's co-chairs, and she's also the dean of Universidad de los Andes in Bogota, Colombia. She said in yesterday's announcement that this is a really diverse group of people that includes the former prime minister of Denmark, a Nobel laureate from Yemen, human rights activists from Pakistan and West Africa. There's also former government officials from Israel and Taiwan.
This board is not designed to be an echo chamber, but to include all the most relevant perspectives that can help us to make better decisions about incredibly challenging content issues.
And Marco, I should note that there are critics who say it's not as diverse as its user base, that there are too many lawyers in this group. And notably, there aren't any experts on disinformation, which, as you know, Facebook has had a huge problem with.
Lydia, is there optimism that this will actually work?
Yeah. If you talk to anyone who's been following Facebook and content moderation, they'll tell you that this is an interesting idea that could at the very least bring some transparency to this process that we really don't know much about. I think we'll have to wait until the board is up and running to see just how much power it really has to keep the company accountable. But I think the most important point to make here, Marco, is you can put a bunch of lawyers and academics in a room to debate these issues all day long. Ultimately, the first offense are the content moderators who have to make these decisions, you know, in seconds. So I'll be really curious to see how the board issues guidelines that your average content moderator can apply in the seconds they have to make these critical decisions.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
It seems like we've been hearing this message forever now.
We must continue to stay home.
Are being told to stay at home as much as possible.
Stay home, stay home.
You must stay at home.
But what if home isn't always safe? The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how the pandemic's lockdown guidelines are impacting the LGBTQ community.
In the past few weeks, calls to helplines have surged.
Switchboard, the LGBT plus helpline. You'll now be transferred to one of our volunteers.
Switchboard, the UK's leading LGBTQ helpline, has seen a 20% increase in people reaching out for support during the COVID-19 pandemic.
It's really staggering.
Natasha Walker, co-chair of Switchboard, said queer people are calling in with increased anxiety and increased fears for their safety. Many have lost their jobs or had school canceled, so they've been forced to spend more time in hostile living situations.
I know we've spoken to people who've come out to their family as transgender or who've come out to their family as homosexual, and the parents aren't dealing with that very well, and those callers are contacting us because they think they're about to be kicked out.
It's a pronounced fear the LGBTQ community is facing around the world.
We know that all of Canada is suffering right now, but we know that some members of our society are suffering more than others.
Helen Kennedy is the executive director of EGAIL Canada, the country's leading LGBTQ organization. She says many people in the queer community have created chosen families outside of their biological families.
We don't have the same family structures as our non-LGBTIQ2S people have. If you are in a situation where you are isolated within a homophobic, transphobic, or biphobic household, for example, then that additional stress on your mental health and physical health just further compounds the problem.
Canada has some of the most advanced LGBTQ laws in the world, and Kennedy said her organization has asked the government to help LGBTQ Canadians during the pandemic. They haven't received a response yet, but organizations in other countries say there's no hope in asking their governments to support queer communities.
We wouldn't get that kind of support from government.
Shauna Stewart is the co-director of We Change, an organization that helps gay and transgender women in Jamaica. Homosexuality is illegal in that country, and for many, homophobia is inescapable.
This morning, someone called me to tell me that she lost her job and she's at home with her family, and it's very, very difficult because she doesn't have any money, and they are quite homophobic, and they're making it difficult for her, not even giving her food.
Stewart found the girl a therapist who will work pro bono.
And we'll try to get food to her as soon as possible.
That's the same strategy Jennifer Okobo is taking. She works for One Action Foundation, an LGBT organization in Nigeria, and has been taking calls from queer Nigerians.
Most of them requested for, you know, monetary support, basic food items. And then some people just requested that they don't really need anything. They just needed someone to talk to.
Okobo and her team put out a call to connect with people who need support. She thought maybe 20 people would reply. But they got 207 responses.
If I'm thinking about supporting one person, that would be roughly $80. So if I have 207 people reach out to me, I don't know where I'm going to get that amount of money to support everyone.
Okobo said right now she only has enough resources to support about 10 people. She sends food to people's homes and calls them for regular check-ins. But Okobo said that many of the people she talks to are reluctant to reveal their identity or address. They're scared of being outed and possibly kicked out of their homes. Natasha Walker at the Switchboard Helpline in the UK says it's their digital services, like email and instant messaging, that have seen the biggest surge in use.
There's a real parallel between being able to reach out to us via instant messaging and email because of concerns about being overheard on the phone, especially within these different circumstances that people are finding themselves in lockdown.
For that reason, today, you won't be hearing the voices of queer people who are feeling trapped in unsafe homes. They're afraid of being identified. But one woman named Bettina, who identifies as a lesbian and lives in Sao Paulo, wrote to me. Someone at her office was suspected of having COVID-19, so Bettina has been forced to spend all her time living under her parents' roof. She says they're homophobic. "I definitely do not feel comfortable at home," Bettina wrote. "My parents make sure I know they are not okay with my choices every day, and being a lesbian made them so disappointed in me that no matter what I do, it's never enough. I feel like I'm watching my life go by through somebody else's eyes because I'm not who they want me to be, but I also can't be myself when I'm in their house." Bettina told me that she tries to stay busy by cooking and working. She tries to stay calm by meditating, and she's reached out to a few LGBT friends. "It's good to be able to talk with people who understand," she wrote. Natasha Walker from the Switchboard Helpline said doing that, reaching out to other people and staying connected, is the best thing for the queer community to do right now.
One thing that the LGBTQ plus communities have always done is evolve and adapt to changing situations. We're a hardy bunch who are really, really good at supporting each other at our core, and empathy binds us together. So yeah, I have no doubt that we'll get through it, but it's really important that we do that by supporting each other.
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
So, do you need a little more of this voice in your life right now?
Filthy little hobbitses! They stole it from us!
No!
What did they steal?
restless.
If your answer is yes, you are in luck. Andy Serkis, the actor who played the creepy creature Gollum in the Hobbit movies, will be returning to the screen tomorrow. Not the big screen, of course, but your computer screen. Serkis will read All of the Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien nonstop on a live stream. He'll be raising money for charity.
I want to invite you to come with me on an adventure on Friday, May the 8th at 10 a.m. GMT.
That'd be 6 a.m. on the U.S. East Coast, but if you're not an early riser, fear not. The Armchair Marathon across Middle Earth is expected to last a dozen hours. And if weeks of lockdown haven't pushed the bickering in your household to the max already, there's new streaming content from another fantasy world competing for ears and bandwidth.
Hi, I'm Daniel Radcliffe, and this is Chapter 1 of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Celebrities and cast members of the Harry Potter films are reading the first book in the Wizarding series aloud, one chapter a week, starting this week.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of Number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Whatever it takes during this pandemic to keep you all feeling perfectly normal, books, baking, even listening to the radio, it's all good as long as you're staying safe. That's going to do it for us here at The World Today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.